Well, good afternoon. I'm Mark Sheeland. I'm Director of Programs here at the Middle East Institute. It's a pleasure to welcome you all to our first public event of 2018. We're excited to host the expert speakers on this panel, which we've entitled Countering the Weaponization of Information. I expect an eye-opening and informative discussion on the intersection of information technology, activism, extremism, politics, and warfare. We are live streaming and recording this discussion for posting on the MEI website. We ask that you silence your mobile devices, but we do encourage tweeting. Please use the hashtag MEI event. The idea for this panel came to us from Harun Ulla, who last year released the book Digital World Wars. We're happy to host Harun and Nancy Payne from USIP as panelists here at MEI for the first time, and to welcome back our friend Shadi Hamid from the Brookings Institution. Our moderator will introduce the panelists more thoroughly as he starts the conversation. Leading the event today is my colleague Charles Lister, a senior fellow at MEI and director of our extremism and counterterrorism program. In his research, Charles draws on a remarkable network of people built up in part through his own direct engagement with the leaders of over 100 Syrian armed opposition groups over several years. He's in high demand in government circles and in the media as an analyst and commentator on the Syrian insurgency and on armed jihadism more broadly. He appears regularly on television and his articles are published in many major outlets. He has a critically acclaimed book out, The Syrian Jihad, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and the Evolution of an Insurgency. Do take a look at that. Our speakers' bios, somewhat longer format, are in the flyer that you picked up on your way in. We're delighted that they are all here to speak to this topic and that you've all come out today to join us. Thank you again for doing so. We'll reserve ample time for your questions before we conclude at 1:30 today. Thank you again, and please welcome Charles Lister and our panel.
Thank you very much, Mark. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you again for coming to MEI's first event of 2018. And yes, it is 2018. I'm still getting used to the new year. We gather here, I think, at a crucially important and I think also a very interesting time. As the technological sophistication of non-state revolutionary or terrorist actors, I think, is increasing exponentially. We're here, I think, as Mark said, to talk about countering the weaponization of information, but clearly the weaponization of information is just as important a facet of the discussion. Intriguingly, from my perspective, talking about technological sophistication, just a few days ago, opposition fighters in Syria launched a swarm of 13 handmade drones towards Russia's main military bases on the northwest coast along the Mediterranean. About half of them managed to evade Russia's highly sophisticated air defense capabilities. Much was made last year and the year before of ISIS's use of drones. Those drones had a range of as much as 50 times smaller than the handmade drones made of wood, aluminium, and lawnmower engines that then were launched at these Russian bases just a few days ago. Rebels in Syria are retrofitting old anti-aircraft missiles so as to prolong their aged batteries by plugging them into car batteries. That's just Syria, and that's one facet of the technological sophistication. But we're meeting here today to talk about something a little different, but complementary. And that is, as I say, the weaponization of information on the internet, on mobile devices, on cell phone devices, and on the dark web under the surface. From the dark web to artificial intelligence bots, heavily encrypted messaging apps, public propaganda campaigns, targeted disinformation campaigns, crowdsourcing recruitment drives, non-state actors and state actors are arguably outcompeting many of their other state-based adversaries these days. And that's a worrying state of affairs for anyone concerned. So how has this state of affairs come to be? What are the biggest threats and emerging challenges? And most importantly, how are our governments seeking to counter them? I'm lucky enough today to have a superb panel to tackle this important and complex subject. Beginning on my left, we have Nancy Payne, Chief Operating Officer of the USIP-based Peace Tech Lab, which uses media, technology, and data innovations for peace building. Previously, Nancy was Managing Director for Communications at the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. She's also managed technology client activities for international communications agencies, now in the Weber Shandwick Network, and started her career in broadcast news as a reporter and photographer. To my immediate right, we have Shadi Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a contributing editor for The Atlantic. He's the author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World, Temptations of Power, Islamists and a Liberal Democracy in a New Middle East, as well as co-editor of Rethinking Political Islam, I think his most recent book. An expert on Islam and politics, Shadi has served as Shadi previously served as briefly as my boss, I think maybe for a week, as director of research at the Brookings Doha Center until January 2014. And then finally, on the far right, we have Haroon Ullah, who currently serves as chief strategy officer at the Broadcasting Board of Governors, an $800 million global media agency. Prior to joining BBG, Haroon advised three secretaries of state, traveled with Ambassador Richard Holbrooke's Afghanistan-Pakistan team, and started the first ever public diplomacy countering violent extremism office at any American embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan. His award-winning books include Vying for Allah's Vote, The Bargain from the Bazaar, and his most recent book, and the original catalyst for this discussion, The New Digital World War. So I thought I'd start today by pitching a few general questions to our panelists, and then I think hopefully open it up to a discussion amongst ourselves, and then open up for plenty of Q&A with the audience. So we'll see how that all goes. But I'll start with Haroon. Big picture question to start with. The common narrative around terrorism today is one of victory. People talk of ISIS as a defeated entity. They rarely, if ever, acknowledge the existence of the little-known group known as Al-Qaeda, never mind the many other dozens of other terrorist threats that we face today. I and others along this panel and elsewhere would be happy to counter the narrative of the ground reality, but I want to ask you about the state of the information and internet battlefield. What is it that these terrorist actors, the broad spectrum of them, what is it that they're doing particularly successfully that a general audience needs to know more about and that which governments need to be focusing more on in terms of countering those threats?
Great. Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. Thanks for Middle East Institute for putting this together. And I couldn't think of a better panel. I'm big fans of all the work of my colleagues here. So I would say, you know, in terms of big picture, we have what I call as on this information battlefield. So, you know, a lot of people, including sometimes myself, when we saw the pictures in Raqqa of sort of it being, you know, we thought mission accomplished about a month or two ago. And I think a lot of people felt that we've made these huge gains, and we have on the physical battlefield. But what I think we underestimated was that the battlefield that a lot of these groups, whether it's like ISIS or Boko Haram or Al-Shabaab, care about most and where they are making the most unexpected gains is on what I call the information battlefield. So they've set up this sort of David and Goliath narrative where they can lose on one battlefield but actually gain on a very different battlefield. So to answer your question, Charles, I'll throw out three ideas of why this information battlefield is so important and what are the sort of the maybe counterintuitive lessons that we should take from it. So let's take ISIS, for example. One big thing I'll throw out there is that at the heart of it, what we underestimate is that this is a content war. It is a content war. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you look at the ecosystem that ISIS has built up online, and the amount of online sort of memes and social media, both edutainment that they're putting out. And they believe in this mantra that narrower the audience, bigger the impact. So they have this idea of who to reach out to. And, you know, for example, as I did research for my book, Digital World War, I was interviewing defectors. And I wanted to understand, you know, what is it? What is the appeal of the propaganda? You know, what is it the appeal? And when I was in the Gulf and I was interviewing ISIS defectors and built this database, one of my first questions to them was, "What? Well, in one word, describe to me ISIS." And in my mind, I thought about what I would hear. Maybe these defectors, so horrific, maybe like, you know, they would say things like dark, or maybe they would say, you know, murderers, they were upset because they had defected. But what I heard instead was trust. I heard loyalty. I use this word in Arabic called amanat, which means sort of, again, it's a powerful word for trust or being trustworthy. And I heard belonging, identity. And it was I was thinking to myself, where's the disconnect? Where's the disconnect in terms of what my own thinking is about this and someone who's a defector and where they're coming from? And what I realized is that ISIS, you know, if the tagline was, you know, what marketers could learn from terrorists, they are messaging something very different in Arabic than they message in English. So if you look at, when I went back and looked at it, about 80% of their messaging in Arabic is positive messaging. It's sort of kittens and Nutella. It's about governance. It's about, you know, getting rid of corruption. And so they're appealing to this very positive message. It's not the grisly things that we see in English. And if you think about it, they are smart about audience segmentation. And so they're saying one thing in English, something very different in French, something different in Russian. And actually, English is not even in the top five languages of what they message in. So at the heart of it, again, as I talk about, is it a content war? And for a lot of us, again, that may not follow Arab media, I oftentimes ask, who is the number one person on Twitter in the Middle East? Anyone know? What's that? No, close. Anyone know? Who is it? Amr Diab? I know it's a little old time in terms of music. Is it an actress, an actor? Is it, you know, a politician like King Abdullah? Any ideas? Well, the number one person on Twitter in the Middle East is Mohammed al-Arafi. Mohammed al-Arafi is an extremist religious cleric based in Saudi Arabia and about 20 million followers on Twitter. And he's not just prolific on Twitter. He's prolific on Snap. He's prolific on other platforms. And he's probably the single biggest reason that young people have gone and joined ISIS and got up and bought a ticket and traveled over to Syria or Iraq. And it was based on my own data. And he doesn't violate terms of service, but he's part of this sort of fanboy ecosystem in terms of aggregating and amplifying messages. So he'll put out things where he'll show a bushel of apples, and he'll say, the caliphate is bountiful. Now, does that violate terms of service on Twitter? It doesn't. But there's all this messaging that he goes up to the line, and he's very skillful as, you know, I call it that he does these things called snap fatwa. So he does these things which are, he's making a change narrative, he has charisma, he's gone straight to the consumer. 80% of Saudi youth follow him. He has a huge following in the Middle East. So one is, this is a content war, and as my colleague Catherine Collins, who works at State Department and runs one of the best programs in terms of film and sort of media, the what we've found in terms of this content war is, if you look at what was the number one drama in the Middle East last year, anyone know? On TV? Any guesses? It's a program called Selfie, produced by the Middle East Broadcasting Corporation, Selfie and Black Crows. 18 million people watched it. And you know what? It counters ISIS. It makes fun of ISIS. It's very brave what Ali Jaber, who's the managing director, they've gone after them. We need 10 of them. So one, I want to get across the point, is content wars. Two is, I talked about this idea of, you know, audience segmentation. They're saying one thing in one language, one other things, and they understand how to reach narrow audiences, right? So now you see that they've developed where they're crowdsourcing some of their way that they recruit. They have their own version of like a Kickstarter campaign to recruit. They've obviously evolved and modified. In a lot of ways, they're morphing to what I call the cloud caliphate. You know, so they've understood that they have to evolve their strategy in terms of as they lose more territory on the physical battlefield, and they're putting more resources into this ecosystem. The third thing, and then I'll defer to my colleagues to pick up this conversation, is this sort of mantra, speed kills. And I think what ISIS has learned in their on this information battlefield is they're able to fail fast and then try new things. So you see a lot of iterations where they try certain propaganda in terms of recruiters, but they drop it and they move on to something very different. Obviously, that's not religiously grounded. They'll move to other ways, looking at political grievances, identity grievances. But there's this idea that they're able to show what I call platform agility. So the irony is that, and I'll give you, and I'll end here, is that, you know, about a month or so ago, we had on a panel like this on Capitol Hill, you had three of the internet companies on testifying, Google, Twitter, YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. And we were talking about censorship and how do we identify disinformation. And the interesting thing is that, you know, they started using these 3 years ago. They've moved beyond those platforms. That's not even where they're putting all their attention. They're on platforms like Saraha. Anyone here use Saraha? Right? Number one now app in 25 countries, more popular than Snapchat. It was created by a Saudi entrepreneur, meant to be kind of like a sort of honest feedback platform. It's like your old school version of a high school bulletin board. But it's now used ISIS to bully and to recruit. So you see this incredible kind of platform agility in terms of how they're being able to evolve and adapt. And this idea of speed kills, they really understand what is it. Now we know about Telegram, we know about other ways, but they've now learned how to move from open source to closed source into encrypted platforms, again, to reach those audiences. We see evidence of them using Bitcoin to raise money. So again, I just want to sort of, I think that understanding these trends will give us a better sense of how to combat it.
Great, Haroon. Fantastic first answer. I think that's given us a very good impression of the general challenge ahead. And I wanted just to shift to Nancy next. So we've got an idea of some of the challenges that we face, some of the threats that have emerged, that are continuing to emerge. Nancy, as far as I understand it, where you work at Peace Tech Lab, your work is more on the kind of practitioner level. Would it be possible just to start off by telling us all a bit about what exactly you're doing, the new kind of methods you're using to try and combat these kind of things, and you know how you think some of those things are working best and maybe areas for improvement in the future?
Definitely. So for those of you who have not heard of Peace Tech Lab, we're about a three-year-old organization. We're a 501c3, so we're an independent nonprofit, but we had the good fortune of being able to spin off from the U.S. Institute of Peace. So we're actually still co-located at USIP, still get the benefits of being able to tap into that level of expertise. But my organization, Peace Tech Lab, actually looks at using technology, media, and data to be able to scale and accelerate peace-building efforts. So our mission is a little bit different, but very complementary to what the Institute does. But what we do essentially is bring together conflict experts social scientists and data scientists. We bring together entrepreneurs and engineers and activists, all trying to actually tackle through very different lenses and very different frameworks, how do you actually resolve violent conflict? So we continually ask ourselves, how do we actually get the right tools in the right hands? And from what Haroon just said, that's exactly what terrorist organizations and extremists are doing as well, and they're mastering that. So we're in very similar ways actually going through the same calculus and the same evaluation. We're looking at audiences, we're looking at segmentation, and we're trying to figure out from a peace builder perspective what's going to be most effective in the particular context in which people work. But we do this in a variety of ways. We do this through our field work, which I'll explain in just a second, both using low-cost, easy-to-access technologies and getting those tools into the hands of the people who can wield them best, all the way over to co-creating content, media content, with local partners that is curriculum-driven, research-driven, but has a really strong underlying message that is not necessarily counter-narrative. It's alternative narrative. It is really emphasizing social cohesion trying to actually address very specific issues around, you know, gender, around national unity, around kind of finding common ground and shared interests and shared values. So that's a bit of the distinction, I think, with us in sort of more traditional direct counter-narrative programming. We do that work in the field that actually is using this technology that's still available. We also accelerate and scale. So we actually have the world's first peace tech accelerator where we actually bring technologists into our building and work with them on a curriculum-based program and actually help them attract investment. So when I mentioned working with entrepreneurs, we actually work very closely, including very great examples of some companies that we've had most recently from the Middle East, where they've been able to attract investment while at the same time actually tackling some of these really complex, difficult issues. So we're shifting the concept of peace building away from government only and toward other players and other actors who can actually get into this area. We work with corporate partners, we work with entrepreneurs, and people who are actually trying to apply a for-profit model. So the best example I can give you on that side right now with some of our work is in Pakistan and in Nigeria. We actually partner with nationally known, nationally recognized media companies. So we're going from working with local production companies and producing one-off shows to actually working with the distribution channels. So those distributors, those for-profit commercial model media companies are saying, hey, well, look, we've actually got some problems with extremism in our countries. In Nigeria's case, it's northern Nigeria. In Pakistan's case, it's the challenges that you're all very familiar with. And they have said there's an information need not being served. News, entertainment, none of that's being served by any of the commercial model media companies right now. We want to move in and fill that gap for the 15 to 25 to 30-year-old audience. So we're working very closely with them, and as they develop brand new networks that are in language, very specific, audience segmented to a younger person's audience, where they're actually bringing in young people to work there. They're hiring at a rapid rate, at least in Pakistan, people that are going to be news presenters and actually help them form the entertainment. It's going to change the dynamic completely in terms of that access to news and information that, again, is an alternative narrative that gets back to, again, referencing Haroon's key words, I think, that he was learning, which are loyalty, belonging, trust, identity. And so I'm gonna stop there. But I think it's what we're trying to really do is to present a completely a new dawn as well, a new way of thinking about things, an alternate way of thinking about things, through a variety of new narratives and stories. I think the second piece of what we're doing in the field that's also very relevant to how information moves is we actually do monitoring and reporting. So a lot of our data work is around taking a look at social media channels and how, whether it's extremist speech or hate speech, how that information is actually moving and flowing. And one of the things that we realized early on in our work was many people, when you go to counter these extremist messages, they go directly to countering. They might jump in at monitoring, but nobody's actually starting with identifying it. So we created a model about 3 years ago that said identify, monitor, counter, and many people, we put our stake in the ground on identification, because a lot of people actually assume that you know hate speech, dangerous speech, extremist speech when you see it, but that's actually a completely, that's not the case at all. You've actually got to really get in, understand the context, understand the audience, and start to identify very specific terms, which we then, in a human, human curated capacity, but then we use machine learning, and we've got a number of tools that we use to be able to use technology to actually start to train and learn and much more rapidly follow and track, how this information is being shared and what specific information is being shared and what is actually driving then offline violence. I'm going to leave it there.
Fascinating. Thank you, Nancy. I'll turn now to our third panelist, Shadi. So we've heard a little bit about the extremist terrorist challenge. We've heard a little bit about what some form of practitioners can do in response. Shadi, your work has generally focused more on the political Islamist environment, particularly in the Middle East. So I kind of wanted to ask you a two-part question. The first one is, what are non-violent political Islamists doing in terms of their use of the internet, their use of, or their construction of their own narratives? Is the proliferation of their narrative on the internet being any more successful than the proliferation of violent extremist narratives? Are they failing in that respect? Clearly they want to create a counter-narrative for their own. And the second part of the question is kind of interrelated to that. And I've seen firsthand in the region how the clerical establishments in certain countries are trying to create their own counter-narratives using their own religious infrastructures. But frankly speaking, I haven't really necessarily seen any of those being hugely effective. Very often their ability or their agility on the internet is
severely lacking in comparison to the people that they're trying to counter. So to what extent do you think they have any hope of succeeding? Are they the most credible voices that we could hope for in terms of a true counter-extremist narrative?
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Charles. Just before I start, I'll just say that I'm relatively young, but I didn't realize that people are calling it Snap now. I just call it Snapchat. So, I mean, Haroon is very he's very with it. So I focus on mostly on mainstream Islamists, so primarily nonviolent and groups that are obviously very much at odds with ISIS and Al-Qaeda. They have not been, these groups that are mostly Muslim Brotherhood or Brotherhood-inspired movements, have not been nearly as successful on social media as ISIS has been. And that might seem surprising at first in the sense that they have a larger following, they're more popular, they've either won majorities or pluralities during the Arab Spring period, but they've really struggled since repression has increased after the Egyptian coup of 2013, and there's been a push against Islamists throughout the region. They've struggled to kind of respond in real life, but also online, and to kind of project a strong presence and a strong narrative. And in some ways, their narrative simply isn't as compelling because they failed at governance in Egypt. They've struggled and split in Jordan. Now in Egypt, there is actually probably, I would say, an unprecedented divide in the Egyptian Brotherhood in exile. So these groups are really facing some challenges. That's not to say they haven't tried and haven't had some successes, but generally speaking, I would say ISIS has done better in this arena. And I think one reason that ISIS has done better is part of what Haroon was getting at, that this is a content war, and ISIS, at least from 2014 to 2016, during their period of success and prominence before they lost most of their territory, actually had quite a bit to point to. And I think this is very important to emphasize, and I'm happy that Haroon did, because we don't usually think of ISIS as having an affirmative message of governance. But that's really, I think, one part of what made ISIS unique, is that they had this pronounced interest in governance and in holding territory and doing things with that territory in terms of putting up somewhat complex and developed institutional structures. And you might remember when there were a bunch of articles about ISIS having, a Consumer Protection Bureau and things like that. So there was an effort on the part of ISIS to kind of project this image of a utopian Islamic State. And obviously a lot of this was propaganda and rhetoric, but it tells us something, that they thought those quote-unquote positive message would resonate with people, and especially in Arabic language production, this idea that people would come to the Islamic State because this is where the caliphate was being established and where people could live a very strict and pure Islamic life, if you will. So I think that's important, and that again is a contrast between what ISIS was able to accomplish and what mainstream Islamists like the Brotherhood were not able to accomplish, in the sense that groups like the Brotherhood were not able to govern effectively, with the possible, Tunisia might be one partial exception where there's maybe a more positive narrative, but that's pretty much it. Now, on the second part of the question on the clerical establishment, I think oftentimes in the West, when we think about countering extremism, and we want to promote counter-narratives, we automatically jump to this idea of promoting moderate clerics. And I mean, not to get into this too much, but I hate the word moderate in this respect for a lot of reasons. But I think one problem is this idea that there is something called a moderate set of clerics who are sort of the natural antidote to extremism. And we oftentimes will think about Al-Azhar as the premier Sunni Islamic establishment in the region, but we also think a lot about governments. And of course, Al-Azhar is, in some sense, has become more of a mouthpiece for the Egyptian government. But a lot of these religious establishments have very close ties to regimes, and that that undermines their ability to provide an effective counter-narrative. I think that we as Americans oftentimes are very tempted by the idea of our allied regimes, our friends in the region, playing this forward role. But we have to understand there are built-in limitations because oftentimes these are repressive regimes. And if you're someone who's predisposed to radicalism or radicalization, if you're a young person that's angry about the political situation, you're probably not going to put a lot of trust into religious elites that have ties to existing regimes. That is not going to be compelling to you because for you, what you're looking for is an anti-establishment message. So I think that's going to be a challenge going forward, and I don't think we as the U.S. or the U.S. government have a very great good answer to that particular predicament.
Shelley, I'll just quickly follow on from your answer. Just while we're on the subject of moderate and immoderate, let me ask you a tough question. And feel free to not take a position on it if you don't want to. But is there any way in which a more effective counter-narrative to violent extremism could be posited by, say, for example, a quietist Salafi vis-a-vis a liberal pro-democracy secularist?
Yeah, well, so, first of all, I don't think the answer is trying to promote secular liberal voices because, again, who's our target audience? Our target audience is people who might be tempted by ISIS's message. So we're talking about people who would find a liberal or secular message compelling, that's not the same audience as the people we're worried about, the people that we're ostensibly talking about who are at risk of radicalization. So we have to find a little bit of a different narrative. Now, I think that you might recall Graham Wood's famous Atlantic article, What ISIS Really Wants. A lot of aspects of that article got a lot of attention. The one part that I thought was in some ways the most interesting and intriguing part of the article, almost no one talked about, where Graham actually talks about quietist Salafis as being an effective counterweight to groups like ISIS because they share the same theological orientation. And I think there is something to be said for Salafis generally, and most Salafis are nonviolent, and a minority are violent, obviously. But because Salafis kind of speak the same theological language, they're maybe better able to appeal to some of these younger anti-establishment people in the region. I think there's arguments on both sides, but I think what was interesting to me about that, it was at least a creative idea, even if it was wrong. And I think we should generally try to err on the side of being more open and creative on these challenging questions. But at the very least, we shouldn't exclude nonviolent Salafis or quietist Salafis and say, and just lump them together and say they're part of the extremist problem. I think that would be a real mistake. And I'll just mention one anecdote. There's an American religious scholar who I won't name, but some of you might be able to guess who it is. But he doesn't define himself as a Salafi now, although he definitely was a Salafi before. He's sort of like a post-Salafi, but he still has a kind of Salafi theological orientation to some extent. And he was talking about, I remember one time he was talking about how it's very hard for people like him to kind of make their case and to have room to convince people to move away from radicalization because people view him in some sense as part of the problem, and no one sees that approach as being potentially successful, where knowing his kind of rhetoric, he might be better placed to talk to some more strict conservative youth in American cities, for example.
Right. Okay, fantastic, great. I think before we go to open up to Q&A, I'm going to throw three kind of issues or questions out, and I'm going to just go back in the reverse order the way we started, and feel free to respond to any or all of them. The first one is, how can we better tackle the challenges of creating credible voices to push a counter-narrative, and with the idea of trying to tackle root causes rather than just the immediate problem? That's number one. Number two is something I read about recently, I think, in the Washington Post, is that the U.S. military has sort of stepped its foot now in kinetic
cyber efforts against extremism. So in the last 12 to 18 months in Syria and Iraq, U.S. Cyber Command was I'm not sure of the exact technical terms, but committing attacks against ISIS computer systems from the air, changing email passwords, changing social media passwords from the air, deleting video content from the air. How much are these kind of kinetic efforts actually going to contribute to something durable and lasting? Is it almost an effective deterrent, or is this something that's literally just knocking down one threat after another before another one raises its head? So that's number two. And then the third one is something that I've thought a lot about over the last few years in terms of the Syrian examples. How can we get over the enormous bureaucracy and the lack of interconnectivity between various different levels of effort in countering violent extremism and countering extremist narratives? And I'll just tell one anecdote of my own, which I know from quite personal experience. There was a video released during the height of ISIS's brutality. They were at the time beheading American and British hostages. And there's a rebel group in northern Aleppo whose senior religious or leading Islamic official approached his media team and said, listen, we need to create a counter-narrative video to ISIS. And the video was, as far as I remember, about 8 minutes long. The first 2 or 3 minutes were an exact copy of a kind of ISIS mass execution video. So they dressed the rebel fighters up in ISIS uniforms, all exactly the same. They marched them in with dramatic music, carrying big daggers and knives, with 8 guys in orange Guantanamo-style uniforms. So the first 3 minutes of the video looked like, okay, we know what's going to happen. And then just at the moment where they were about to behead these 8 prisoners, they put the knives back in their sheaths, and the video frame shifted to the religious leader of this group, who then gave a lecture on how Islam was much more about forgiveness than it was about an eye for an eye and et cetera, et cetera. Now, the only reason why I bring this up as an anecdote is within about half an hour of that video first being published, YouTube deleted it for breaking its content rules. The idea was it looked like an ISIS video, so it was removed. And for about 36 hours, this group reposted the video, and every single time it was removed. So what I saw, at least, as a potentially very effective attempt, local attempt, at countering an extremist narrative in a conflict zone, was repeatedly taken down by the content platform that ought to have been really doing more to try and spread this. So that's with the bureaucracy and interconnectivity of an effort. How can we try and counter that? So there's 3 questions. We'll start with Haroon. Feel free to tackle any or all of them.
Great. That's a very good anecdote, and that's a good lead-in to sort of, I'd say at the outset, sort of one of my headlines, and I write a lot about this in my book, is that we need a new Manhattan Project. We need a new Manhattan Project on this information battlefield. And what I mean by that is that, by the way, I grew up in Hanford, Washington, which is one of the first 2 places where the Manhattan Project actually worked. My dad is a nuclear engineer, so it's very close to home. But, part of it is that, as somebody I did my doctoral work in game theory, and I think of it sort of tragedy of the commons. We have a collective action issue around this. We literally have the best minds. Some of them are sitting here, Ambassador Rafael, other ambassadors. We have content creators, Mahreen from Word. We have Catherine. We have some of the best minds on this issue. We actually have the best stories. I met thousands of young Malalas in the region. I'm just thousands of young Malalas with inspiring, authentic, organic stories that are the perfect sort of compelling counter narratives. As we know, I take a data-driven approach in a lot of my work, is that tit for tat messaging doesn't work. Actually, it creates what we call backfire effect, where actually it reinforces predisposed beliefs. You have to think about alternative messaging, alternative sort of audience architecture, and we can't put all these pieces together. And we have the best technology. We have the best technology mind. So if you think about all these pieces, it's really tragic that on the information battlefield we are unable to put together and to turn the tide. Another thing I found in my research was what I called, the 1-9-90 model, which is that on social media, 1% of people are content creators. Those are the key influencers. 9% are what we call content curators, and they share content. And 90% are sort of passive consumers. And part of what I talk about is Manhattan Project is how do you get more of that 90% into these other two categories? How do you get them, quote unquote, off the sidelines to sort of, you know, give them pathways where they can help out? And, you know, Charles, you mentioned Cyber Command. You know, what's interesting about Cyber Command is that, does anyone know when Cyber Command actually became a unified command? In August of 2017. They became a full-fledged unified command. That's fairly recent, if you think about it, in terms of actually being able to carry out end-to-end operational things. And this is 3.5 years after we first noticed ISIS on the information battlefield. And I should mention that as we talk about ISIS, there's already ISIS 3.0 and 4.0 already out there. So we're sort of talking about ISIS, but actually, to go back to 2014, and as many of us that have studied sort of extremism phenomena, if you think of sort of, you know, the Taliban in sort of elementary school, and if you think of Al-Qaeda as sort of in junior high, well, ISIS was in college, and ISIS 3.0 is much further ahead than that. And so this thing that I talk about, speed kills, is they're evolving very quickly. These new groups, whether it's Tahrir al-Sham, which I write a lot about, or others that are sort of thinking about, and they're thinking about, you know, in terms of using this technology in a very different way. So one is you have this sort of, I would say, collective action issue about how to solve it. You know, part of it is a resource issue, I should say. So having worked at State Department for many years and seen a lot of the good work that many of our officers continue to do there, you know, the first iteration of the Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications, as some of you might remember, their budget was about $5 million. And I love my military colleagues. The military band's budget is about $400 million, okay? And so you got to think about part of this is resource intensive in terms of content creation. I know a lot of people will say, and I've done the research on this, a lot of people say, no, USG-produced content will never work. You know what the data shows? Bad content doesn't work. So it's not USG content. There's fantastic USG content. There's amazing work, Catherine can tell you, that we enable, we amplify young voices, that we work with others. It's part of it is finding those key influencers. And so I think part of that is our engagement with those young people in the region, building relationships with, you know, the work that Nancy does and Peace Tech Lag is really on the frontier. They're creating social media incubator hubs, you know, and many of these already exist. So the answers are already there in the region. One of the best places that does this, surprisingly, is in Saudi Arabia. It's a firm called U-Turn, which is based out of Jeddah. They do some of the best content that's countering ISIS. Most of their content goes viral. They're sort of this, you know, they're producing all sorts of alternative animation, comedy, videos, but with an idea of reaching some of those same audiences of sort of at-risk or vulnerable youth. And you have lots of those littered across the Middle East and South Asia and Southeast Asia. Even a YouTube space, for example, which if you think of as sort of a hub to sort of create content, their new YouTube space in Dubai is now one of the top 5 YouTube spaces in the world. So there's a hunger in the region, I think, to produce this content. Young people are already doing it. It's so what I think of this Manhattan Project is how do you provide more of those avenues? Now, I'll also tell you what does work from a data-driven perspective, right? Because there's a lot of theories about what work, and we can have a long debate about, you know, I'll tell you, at least in what my own research shows, defectors, stories of defectors, not just attitudinal changes, we find behavior changes. Those stories are incredibly powerful. That probably is not sort of, you know, super surprising to most people. It's a similar idea around former gang members or former drug users. They have credibility with the target audience, and they can say, look, I was like you, I was frustrated, I had an identity grievance, I too wanted to go to a Club Med for foreign fighters. And, you know, I ended up going there and I experienced X, Y, and Z. I was a plumber. I was this. They're hypocrites. They have no basis in the religion, you know, and they're able to tell those stories. So how do you amplify those stories, right? We actually don't have a way for them to get their narrative out there to sort of get – there's some versions of this, like Abdullah X that tries to talk about – there's an animation based out of London that tries to talk about some of these narratives. But that's one area. Two, the voices of women, especially mothers. You find it incredibly, incredibly influential. I can't overemphasize how some of these narratives are incredibly powerful, especially for young men. And so you think about the stories of mothers. And again, it's not just attitudinal changes. We actually have some data that shows on behavioral changes. And so that's very important. And then you talk about the sort of, again, the content creation, the selfies and the black crows and these dramas and others that are this content that's out there that, you know, and part of what you evaluate is that ISIS, with content like black crows, I mean, most of the actors and actresses on the set, the others that produced that, they got virtual beheadings by ISIS because they knew this was directly tackling one of their key narratives, and it was having a huge effect. So there's a lot of, I think, this organic, authentic content that can be enabled. But I also think that we have to have an eye towards the future, right? So, and I almost think, this is probably the wrong terminology, but some version of like cyber SEALs. That there is this, that we have to think about sort of enabling a new cadre of people that are actually, when you talk about kinetic operation, there's a whole suite of things. There's things on the open source side, but then there's things that get on the intel side in terms of, you know, detection and encryption and censorship. I tend to think that some of the censorship thing gets more, it gets overplayed. You know, the tech companies are doing a good job, I think, in they're rapidly changing. We all know Will McCann, so hopefully that YouTube problem, Will who was the one of the directors at Brookings is now at YouTube and will catch all those videos. Because I remember even 3 years ago when I was sitting with Monica Bickert at Facebook and their global public policy team, we were looking at content and one of the young staffers said to me, this is ISIS content we took down. And I looked at it again and I was like, actually, this is a Kurdish nationalist movement. And so they're building up their expertise. You have like people like Brian Fishman and others now at Facebook. So that's improved. But I think that censorship is only one small part. And it gets overplay. You know why it gets overplay? Because it fits in with a lot of regimes in the Gulf and other places that naturally are inclined towards censorship. And I guess I should make this point that we talk about non-state actors, but this idea of the weaponization of information is much broader. It's also talking about state actors. You find the Iranian regime now shut down the Iranian telecom providers, shutting down Telegram, shutting down the ability for crowdsourcing protesters to find them and to criminalize them. So you find actually state actors in Egypt, across the Gulf that are now, you know, thinking about this weaponization information. So I think it's important to understand it's not just about censorship, but it's enabling alternative positive content.
Great. Thank you very much. Nancy?
I'm rather captivated by this idea of a new Manhattan Project. Haroon, I guess one of the challenges I would throw down for you is I've got a background in doing large-scale behavior change campaigns. What happens when those are successful is there are widespread goals, some measurable objectives set, you find the financing, and then as the organizer, you get out of the way and you get that financing into the people who can actually produce the content and actually start to move the needle. With this idea, Haroon, I'm curious, is that possible? Is that possible for USG to actually find the financing, get it in the right hands, and then actually step back and get out of the way and let them produce?
No. I live it every day. I'm COO of a major TV network in Afghanistan. 67 million people get our signal. There's failure in the messaging. The messaging is wrong.
I promise we'll come to you. No, but we can't hear you through the microphone. But I promise I'll give you a chance.
But
to,
you've answered my question.
So you did answer the question.
Well, but I would say and yes.
Good. Okay.
Yes,
see,
Nancy. I'm a firm
you.
Believer.
Okay, good.
Believer. And I've worked on the ground in multiple embassies in tough environments. And I think it can be done. And I'll tell you why. The power of our public diplomacy, which doesn't often get a lot of attention. And those are very brave people, thousands of officers. They're sort of our loafers on the ground in many hard places. Is that if you think about it like a venture capital approach, we can invest. We have first mover advantage. When you think about the U.S. government, we can invest in young people. We can amplify their stories. We can bring them on exchanges when no one else will because it's not commercial. But yet it's in our mandate to do that. And I've seen time and time, there are lots of successes in terms of how to, again, if you think about it, seed capital to sort of, I did that myself on the ground. I know this exactly. In places where you can take chances on small civil society groups, on others, but it takes a network to defeat a network. And it's about partnerships. You know, it's not easy. It's not something you can just turn on. It's not something, as much as I talk about the information battlefield, we can't forget about the offline pieces. You know, the kiosks and the programmatic pieces. We work with groups of 10 or 15 people, or, you know, the work that Mahreen does with 20 women in Afghanistan that are part of these groups. So I don't want to, you know, with all the focus on online, forget about that aspect. But I think it absolutely can be done. I currently work at the Broadcasting Board of Governors. We amplify those stories every day, whether it's Middle East broadcasting networks. Our live blogs are doing it in a lot of places, even on the recent coverage on Iran. I just think, though, that there has to be a concerted effort. Nadia Shadlow, I know, at the National Security Council is in their new national security strategy. There's an information statecraft. So I think there's kind of a coalescing of ideas around how to elevate it. But it absolutely can be done. And by the way, it has to be done.
Yeah, and I'm all for it. Let's do it. And I think one of the things that PSEC Lab brings to the table in this is a couple of things. One is our we've got a network of over 1,000 civil society organizations that we work with in a variety of countries, over half of whom are actually in the Middle East because of a lot of our work there. I think they are great targets to actually go to and start to look at them as key influencers and actually enlisting those kinds of organizations that are there. They're already doing the hard peace-building work on the ground. Just to answer the first question, I think, on root causes and how do you actually better tackle the challenge in finding better messengers, the one example I will give you that we have seen being effective, and again, it plays into this alternative messaging, is in 2013, from 2011 to 2013, PSEC Lab had an award-winning television show, reality TV show in Iraq, and it was called Salam Shabab. And it followed teenagers, both young men and young women, and it was a challenge-based show. Gave them the opportunity to do team-building work, and they interact in ways that they never, ever would have. We also had an online network as part of that. It is now 5 years later. All of those participants actually have stayed in touch. They've stayed in touch online through a 75,000 participant online channel that we had set up and let it proliferate and let it live. And when ISIS came in, a lot of those young people who are now in their 20s have gone on to become activists and leaders in a movement that have directly countered a lot of these activities. And so, again, those seeds were planted a long time ago before ISIS was even on the scene. But if you do start to lay that kind of groundwork, that takes root. So these ideals actually do start to take root. So, Haroon, let's make it happen.
Yeah, just to address your question on the long-term aspect and root causes a little bit more, I mean, I sometimes get worried that we get very enthusiastic about the tech and online side of this discussion, and it almost comes to be seen as a substitute for substantive policy changes on the ground. And I think we have to be careful that the tech online part of it has to be integrated in a broader policy vision. And if we don't have a broader policy vision as Americans, then all the creative thinking on the tech and online side is going to have, you know, real built-in limitations. And this goes more broadly for how we think about counterterrorism. From a long-term perspective, you don't fight terrorism by fighting terrorism. You fight terrorism by addressing the environment that gives rise to political violence and political extremism. And this is where I'm much more pessimistic. I don't mean to sort of kind of shift the tone a little bit, but this is a very depressing time for the region. So if we look at it at that macro level on the ground, I think we have a lot to be worried about. And if the region is as depressing as it seems to be, then there's less ability to get that good content, those positive narratives, those positive stories. And just a couple examples here. I mean, if you look at the most populous Arab country, Egypt, there is no politics. Egypt has a complete, there isn't competition, there isn't space for civil society, and there's a real depoliticization where people are withdrawing from the political arena altogether. Or if we look, for example, at Iraq and Syria, it's no mistake that the two countries where ISIS gained the most traction were the two countries most riddled by civil war. So if we don't have a vision for how to address or prevent civil war going forward, we're in a very big problem. And then the list goes on. Another example of this is, some of the field work I did in Tunisia was interviewing friends and families of Tunisian foreign fighters who went to join ISIS in Syria. And the one common thread, I mean, stories of radicalization are always quite different and sometimes are quite individual, but the one common thread that I saw in my interviews was Assad's repression and the mass killing of Syrians in that early period of 2011-2012. That's what first got these young Tunisians to think about Syria and to want to know more about what was going on in Syria and what to do to fight the Assad regime. If that part of it wasn't there, then they wouldn't have gone to Syria. So that part of it, it seems almost too obvious to bring it up. But when you have regimes that will continue killing very large numbers of people, that is going to attract some degree of radicalization, even if we get everything else right.
Yeah, and sadly, I would agree. But that's precisely what I meant about the interconnectivity of the effort, which is precisely the point. Fascinating conversation so far. I think we've probably got loads of opportunity for questions. So we'll start here in the front. Yes, sir. And please use the microphone and introduce yourself, if you would.
Thank you. My name is Mohammed Al-Hadrami.
Try again.
Is it on?
Yes.
My name is Mohammed Al-Hadrami. I'm from Yemen Embassy, the new political counselor. Thank you for having us here and for the very informative presentation. From our experience encountering the narrative extremism, we found out the message itself, no matter how articulate it is, or the medium, you know, how you deliver it, it's not as important as the messenger or the credibility of who delivers this message. So how would you factor this in when you design some of your anti-extremism programs? And second, when you have a specific campaign against some sort of narrative out there, how do you measure the success of what you do? Is it based on the views, based on the circulation of your medium? Is it based on the how many attacks happened after that? Because measuring success is really important in designing if this is effective or not. And lastly, after the defeat of ISIS in Mosul, did you notice any shift in strategy in terms of narratives from whatever was remaining from them, from their mediums in the internet? Thank you.
Free for all. Anyone take it on first?
Great questions. I'll tackle the success one first. It's very important, I think, in our work to think about defining success. There's a couple ways in terms of when you think about counter messaging or counter narratives, or you know, in this space and on the information battlefield, we have to sort of we have to measure. So one is you look at, you know, there's sort of on one dimension there's attitudinal changes, right? So like let's take example of Pakistan. I've done a lot of research there, but some of my research showed that there's a direct correlation between the popularity of Al-Qaeda and Taliban to the amount of people they recruit. Okay? So it's not just correlation, there's causation there. Okay? And the more people that they're able to recruit, you find a direct causation to sort of amount of terror incidents they're able to carry out. Okay? So if you think about it from that perspective, and this is interesting because it gets into a long debate, I actually would argue that U.S. popularity is not the right metric to look at in certain places. I know it's on Capitol Hill and other places. I mean, it creates a lot of, you know, dissonance when people are like, it's in single digits and we're giving them billions of dollars, you know, and why is it that that's the case? I actually think that if you think about U.S. national security interests, the one that's more aligned to what we want is we want to essentially, if you think about negative campaign adding, we want to sort of criminalize Al-Qaeda and Taliban, right? Show their hypocrisy in a lot of ways because, and by the way, that's not static. So a lot of people think that that's just constant. No, I can show you the last 6 years, and I'll show you 30% swings. in a place like Pakistan, right? Stratified sampling, key areas, rural, urban, whatnot. So the key is what dips it and what doesn't, right? It's not a static thing. And so you find actually recruitment levels change. So that's one way to sort of measure it, right? Is that if you think about all these groups, you look at sort of measures of how to sort of there's attitudinal changes, and you try to look for proxies for behavior changes, right? And that's always the huge in research. That's always the huge leap, obviously, in terms of thinking about success. So that's one way. I think we also have to think about the measurements. So you know, a lot of measurements. It has to be a collection of measurements. It has to be field experiments. It has to be surveys. It has to be focus groups. It has to be there's a mix of qualitative and quantitative data and how you define it. And you're right about going back to your first part about key influencers. So I think it's very important that you think about who's the messenger oftentimes. That's why I talked about you have to find organic, authentic stories, right? So getting the young Malalas from the region, and having done research in Yemen, I know there's so many powerful stories of young Yemenis, right? And actually Yemen is an interesting example because you have Yemen has the highest number of Americans, people don't realize that, American citizens living than in any other Middle Eastern country, given the number of Yemenis that move back from Michigan. And you have generations, actually, of Yemenis that are third-generation, second-generation Americans that are living there. And so you have stories of how do you amplify those. And this is the part about a network. It's a network to defeat a network. So it's identifying those young people, giving them the platform to sort of allow them to tell their own story, right? It can't be sort of a top-down thing. And so I think those are key areas, and this gets back to also the question of clerics, and you know, as Shadi pointed out, a lot of people that are aligned to the regimes, they lose their credibility. So you have to find people that can speak out, and they're there. So I oftentimes get frustrated when people are like, "We don't hear the answer. Why isn't more people speaking out against it?" I was like, "They're there. They're there. You're not looking in the right places." But it's how do we amplify those stories?
Couldn't agree more. Messenger absolutely is critically important. Just to echo that point with Haroon, one of our partners called RNW, it's formerly Radio Netherlands Worldwide, they actually have a youth panel in Yemen. And they actually get incredible amounts of information, feedback, what's going on in the country. It's all virtual. And that's a really interesting example of how they're tapping into those kinds of messengers for their own programming to then be able to amplify the issues and concerns of the young people there. So messenger, hands down, critically important.
Just very briefly, so I guess we've talked mostly about the Middle East, but I'll just mention something about Muslim communities here in the U.S. There's actually a relatively recent piece of a paper that came out from the University of Michigan's Tamar Mitz, M-I-T-T-S. It's really, she built up a fascinating data set where she looked at 100 community engagement activities from local Muslim communities throughout the U.S., and she was able to track online ISIS sympathy or ISIS support on social media before and after community engagement activities. And she was able to find a significant decrease where there were substantive community engagement and outreach efforts. But there is research like that coming out that does suggest that you can actually measure some of this. That's not to say it's a silver bullet, but and that's where I think American Muslim communities, people who know their own local context and know the religious and social aspects, can really speak to this if we're talking about undermining support for extremism, whether it's in European Muslim communities or here in the U.S.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Shadi. I would abuse my moderating position to answer the one question that wasn't answered, which was Mosul. And very briefly, just to say, ISIS shifted its rhetoric and messaging before it lost Mosul. It already had begun to talk about how we're going underground now, this is the next phase of our operations, we saw this coming, this was an inevitability, our fighters will go to ground and prepare for the next phase, which will be one of guerrilla warfare. So in many respects, you already started to see in some Iraqi provinces like Diyala, ISIS operating in the way that it was pre-capturing Mosul in 2014. Assassinating police commanders at night, night raids, drive-by shootings, small IED attacks, etc., etc. So I would argue we've already seen them adapt to that next phase. It doesn't mean that they're about to capture a major city next month. But it certainly doesn't mean they're dead either. And as we all know, they've done it before. They readapted after the loss, after the US surge. They readapted again in 2010, 2011, and they seem to be doing it again this time. So ISIS 4.0, 5.0, it doesn't matter what number you give it, but the movement is still around. Question, yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Radwan Masmoudi. I'm president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. And for the last 5 years, we've been focusing on Tunisia. And we've been training imams on how to have a counter-narrative against how to counter extremism and radicalism in the mosques, which I think is where the fight really is. I think there is I'm a firm believer in having a counter-narrative, and that counter-narrative has to be Islamic, meaning that it has to come from Islamic roots and explain Islam in a better way, and that Islam is against violence. But how do we do that when we have ISIS and others using extremists in the West, in America, in Europe, against Islam? Their main attraction or the main appealing point is that the West is out against us, is that the West is out to destroy Islam. And we hear here in the U.S. and in Europe a rise in these voices against Islam, lumping all Muslims together, all of Islam together as the enemy, a ban on Muslims, you know. And we hear these voices not only in the White House, in Congress, in the media, you know, everywhere, lumping all of Islam and Muslims as the enemy. You know, what are you doing and what can we do to defeat extremism here at home? Because this is what's feeding into the narrative of ISIS and others in the Middle East, that the West is out to destroy us. The West supports these regimes in Egypt and elsewhere. Even when we had the democracy, the West worked against our democratic governments and overthrew them and replaced them with dictators and supports military coups and dictatorships. And this is the narrative that you know, it has to change. It really has to change if we want to defeat extremism.
Thank you very much. Very important question. I think what we're going to do actually is take three questions and we'll put them all together. So next question over here, please. The woman in the third row.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much again for the interesting panel. I think one of the themes that's kind of coming out throughout everybody's comments are the fact that it's a lot of the negative content which initially draws people's attention. I think that we're seeing that not only here in the U.S. with a lot of divisive content, espoused in the political arena as well as internationally. So it's usually these firebrands that are able to paint this very stark contrast. The world is divided between good and evil. The situation's falling apart. Our communities are in disarray. Everything is lost, right? So that really catches people's attention. And then the solution then, oddly enough, are actually positive themes. Many of the things that Haroon was touching on, issues of loyalty, identity, sense of belonging. And so it seems simple that the response then should be empowering those voices that are already disseminating those positive values. But now, the good news is that our research that we've been doing at Word shows that traditional elements of civil society have been promoting those positive values for centuries, but they lack the same kind of attention-drawing capability to get people's attention in the first place. They're not used to being firebrands. They're not used to drawing this very stark situation. So I'm not suggesting that we do some kind of media training where we get these traditional positive voices to start, speaking in these stark terms. But how else can we leverage media and communication tactics to empower those groups further?
Really good question. Third one, the lady here on the inside. Sorry.
Hi, my name's Haley, and I actually work in running online leadership and pro-democratization programming for Iraqi teenagers. And something that I found really interesting about your discussion is stakeholder engagement. This sort of battlefield is unique in that it's cross-border, it's also cross-field. So we work with funders and sponsors who are both in the United States government and private sector and foundational, as well as foreign governments. And so my question is, how do you see the future of these different fields working together to create a unified message, and what are things we can do to encourage that engagement?
Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll just address Radwan's question about anti-Muslim sentiment. So I guess it's, again, it's pretty intuitive and maybe almost too obvious, but one thing that groups like ISIS want to do is to make American Muslims and European Muslims and Muslims in general feel less a part of their own societies and more alienated. They want to kind of feed off an identity crisis, particularly in Europe. It's a bigger issue in Europe than it is here in the U.S. So anything that we do, or in this case populist parties or far-right parties and movements do to contribute to that environment of anti-Muslim hostility makes integration of Muslims in the West more challenging. It makes community outreach and engagement, which I mentioned earlier, more difficult to do on the local level. So that makes me quite worried about the U.S. because I'm biased because I am an American Muslim. But I think that we've generally done a pretty good job in this country in terms of having a Muslim community that can embrace its American identity but also embrace its Muslim identity. There isn't sort of we're not forcing anyone to choose, where you could argue, say, in France, that there is a sense of having to choose between a more French secular identity versus, let's say, if you're a conservative practicing Muslim, your Muslim identity. So those are things we have to be very cognizant of. And I'll just mention this data point. It's also from the same scholar I mentioned earlier, Tamar Mitz. She based on her data, there does seem to be a real correlation between anti-Muslim hostility in the local level in Europe and online radicalization. And here's one of her findings, which I'll just quote directly. She writes that vote share for far-right parties is associated with a 6% increase in the probability of being flagged as an ISIS account on Twitter. So she was able to look at local data of Twitter and Facebook accounts and to kind of correlate that with how well far-right parties did in some of these countries. So again, that would suggest that with the rise of populism, not just in Europe but also increasingly in our own country, where anti-Muslim sentiment is worse today than it was even after 9/11, that this is something we're going to have to contend with for years, if not decades, to come.
One of the things that strikes me about all three questions is this theme of cross-sector or cross-discipline solutions. So just in hearing this, I think everybody is looking at this and saying, how do we actually do better working together? In no matter who you're actually talking about, what are the ways that you can actually bring different parties, different groups together to do that? So I think to the first question, I am no expert on religion. My colleagues at USIP, there's a whole group that really studies that. But what I have learned from a lot of that work, and actually a non-USIP example of what happened in Charlottesville last summer, is that you had a number of different religious leaders from all religions actually coming together and providing literal moral support. I mean, they were providing that kind of emotional and moral support to everybody. And it was incumbent on them to do this in a cross-religion way. It was not Islam. It wasn't Christians. It wasn't Judaism. It was all of them actually worked together and actually had a plan and took very specific action steps. So I can see how that actually is something that maybe needs to happen here, and it maybe already is. But I think that seems to me to be effective because it actually it projects a very unified message in a situation that actually really needed one. And then I think the, how do you start to, come up with a unified message with regard, I think, to the kind of pro-democracy programs. I'm going to skip that one. Sorry.
Tough question. Arun?
Yeah, I'll just add to and agree with Nancy and Shadi said. when I was interviewing defectors in the region and elsewhere, you know, I was surprised at how little they knew about American Muslims and Muslims living in Europe. In fact, that, you know, the thing is that the if you look at ISIS propaganda, they want a civilizational war. They want that, right? And Stephen Levitt, the well-known economist, has a really good piece on this where he says the return on investment is so high for them to want that, that the incentives are going to continue for them to want to feed into that narrative. And so part of it is that, you know, they're able to use this propaganda of this larger civilizational war to recruit. And I think that what that says, and along with what Nancy and Shadi said, is that actually Islamophobia plays into, drives young people, and Islamophobia actually works against our ability to counter that narrative. So it's very important to sort of, I think through that. And part of the amplifying stories, some of the work that Tamara's done, fantastic work on this, and others have done, is like, how do you, you know, how do you elevate those stories? When I was, again, doing these the research, you know, they when they we actually did this I did this field experiment where, for example, we talked about stories of, like, say, Muhammad Ali or others, and you actually found pretty significant view changes when for some of the young people that actually hadn't heard of him, even though he's most popular and he's one of the most popular Americans abroad. But you find actually attitudinal changes that actually you can show stay over time, and it reduces people's sort of young people that are vulnerable that would want to join ISIS. The other thing I should say about ISIS recruits, just to sort of think about it, you think through a lot of my own work through the years, you know, I grew up in rural America. And so when a lot of times people used to point to me and say, Haroon, explain to us what's going on. I was like, I don't know. I drive a truck and I listen to Garth Brooks. I love country music. It's all true. I was like, I don't know. Just because I'm brown, like, there's only until after 9/11 that people are like, wow, Haroon doesn't sound American, you know, or, you know, where are you from? You speak really good English. You go to international school? And I'm like, no. I grew up in Eastern Washington State. But I mentioned that to say that part of my drive has always been understand. I think the first idea to understanding and to combat the narrative is understand the mindset. Why is it young people go and join these groups? So I did all my doctoral work interviewing young people in Taliban camps and Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And one thing I realized in that work and the work on ISIS is that they actually, some people, a lot of people that joined ISIS had altruistic reasons. They joined because they thought, they saw Bashar al-Assad, one of the worst dictators that's doing genocide, and they wanted to do something. Right? They didn't want to stay at home. They thought this is the best way, one of the biggest genocides of our generation that's happening. They wanted to do something against it. It's like, it's kind of like the, you know, the, for those that can remember, there was a DARE campaign, just like just say no to drugs, that didn't work in the 1980s. And you know, young people didn't just want to stay at home. They wanted to do something. It's almost like you needed a, you know, what Nancy does, it's sort of, I would say, like almost like a Muslim Peace Corps, you know, that you need young people wanted to get up and do things, right? They wanted to sort of, and you can't just say no to something. And time again, I heard these young people, ISIS, say, we know what you're against, but we don't know what you're for. And so I just think it's important to understand that some of the reasons that some of these young people went, we want to make them into the other. Some of these young people. And it's so important in de-radicalization programs and integration programs that you understand that a lot of these young people got caught in a wrong situation at the wrong time. You know, there's 17 countries that obviously criminalize it now, so there's no way for them to come back. I think Denmark's the only country that allows defectors to come back without prosecution. But that's something we have to think about, because not only are they valuable stories in this fight, the defector stories, we have to think about ways to amplify it. Obviously, they should be held responsible for any crimes they committed. But you have to think through, you know, we're just at that tip, you know, that sort of, you know, in versions 3.0, 4.0, 5.0, that this will continue. We have to think ahead of the curve, as sort of Shadi said, about underlying causes.
Right. Yep. And the underlying motivation for a lot of these people, as we know from early on in the Syrian conflict, which again keeps coming up as the primary example, I mean, there are individuals in this country and other European countries under trial now whose internet accounts and everything, of course, been seized. And some of them, we now know, wanted to go and join the Free Syrian Army in 2012 because it was the only thing they knew about that was fighting against the Assad regime and trying to stop the genocide. And it was only later that they became extremist members of such and such and such and such. So the drive as a Muslim living thousands of miles away in Europe or in America, the driving force, at least earlier on in the conflict,
was what was happening on the ground, not who they were going to join. And I have a feeling that that probably stands further through the conflict than perhaps we might necessarily acknowledge now. But I think we'll have to wait another year or two to try and find the data to prove that. We'll take three final questions. I know the gentleman here on the outside in the middle definitely wanted to ask one, so we'll start there.
Jack Pagano, COO of a major TV network in Afghanistan. I've been there last year, and before that I worked as a senior strategist on General Allen's team. It's about risk versus reward. I really come down to it. I think we need a new game plan. That's the question. Almost like what Nick Saban did the other night. Brings in a freshman quarterback, throws the touchdown at the end of the game, and wins the game. Right now, we are, in messaging, failing. And this is not my opinion. This is from the analytics and analysis that we do every day. People come up to us and talk to us. The messaging is not working. And then the risk versus the reward. The government tends to go on the risk factor and decide not to do anything and just let things happen. And that includes the United States. One thing that's coming up, there's 1.2 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan. Right now, everyone is worried what's going to happen in 20 days. In 20 days, they expire. Pakistan is telling everyone they're going to kick them out of the country. Messaging is going to be key in the next 3 weeks, and USG, BBG, whatever, will say we don't have enough time to make the messaging. So my question is, how are we going to throw the touchdown and win the football game?
Good question. Let's go with the gentleman at the back.
Hi, my name is Hani Ukeli. I just wanted to ask your thoughts on centers like the center that was opened last May, the center to counter extremism in Saudi Arabia that included over 50 Muslim states. And how effective are centers like that, and how involved are countries like the U.S. or countries that have seen a huge influx of foreign fighters going into the kind of ISIS territories?
And one final question, the lady in the second from last row.
Hi, Laura Morrow. My question is actually something from the very beginning about the quietest Salafists. I'm somewhat familiar with them, but my understanding is that the way that they practice Islam has more of an internal focus. So if one wanted to make use of that population, is there a way to get them to engage with others as they're practicing and inwardly focused?
Great. Thank you very much. Who wants to start? Shadi again?
Okay. I'm not touching that last question,
we'll start,
so why don't you take that one?
Yeah. So just 2 points. First, on this question of throwing the football, or how do we win? What does it mean to win, and how can we move in that direction? I think we have to set our expectations a little bit realistically. There is no winning. There is no kind of final victory where there's a kind of complete defeat of the things that we're trying to defeat. I mean, we're gonna have to live with this for the rest of our lives. There's no way to undo what's already been done. Maybe we could have had that conversation 20 years ago or 15 years ago. So I think that part of the challenge then is, how do we live with the threat of terrorism indefinitely while doing whatever we can to minimize and limit it? But that's different than winning outright. So that's one thing. On the quietest Salafis, again, I think that the U.S. and Western countries more generally have to be careful about who they're working with on the ground. And certain associations can be challenging. But what I think we can do is make sure that we include ideologically and politically diverse voices in any programming that we do. So we can have the secular and liberal voices, we can have pro-regime voices, but we also need to have you know, a quietist Salafi or two, or someone from a mainstream Islamist movement that's nonviolent. The whole array of voices has to be a part of this broader struggle. And, you know, I see no reason why we can't do that, as long as they're not, as long as they're not legally terrorist groups, or as long as they're nonviolent. There shouldn't be any kind of legal prohibitions against having a more diverse group of voices that we do include in our programming.
I'll jump in, let Haroon have the last word. To the question of, you know, I guess, what is our Hail Mary pass at the last minute to win? Agree, maybe it's not necessarily winning, but nothing is going to change without really looking hard at letting those local voices actually float to the top, giving them the platforms, giving them, in some cases, the funding to be able to actually have a little bit of freedom to go out and actually address these things, local solutions for these local issues. There's an example, it's not necessarily Middle East based, but there's this really great organization in India. It's called Video Voices. And what they do is put you know, the social media tools into the hands of people. They train them very lightly on how you actually tell a good story over video. They collect them, and they actually then float them up to the top to the provincial government. Whether it's fixing a pothole or corruption issues, whether it's sort of extremist voices to kind of counter them and tamp them down, they're providing the format for people who are seeing things in their neighborhoods and actually letting them tell their own stories and floating those up to the top, putting them on YouTube and putting them in different delivery systems to make it a lot more shareable and scalable and actually more accessible. So that's always going to have to happen, I think, very much at the local level. So who's going to actually throw that winning touchdown? It's going to be people. It's going to be people locally to be able to do that. In terms of effectiveness, the Center for Counterextremism and these things, I'm not necessarily coming out of the U.S. government, so I don't know if you can actually speak to whether or not those are going to be effective or not. I think there's a good way to do them, and I think what they do provide is a concentration of resources and maybe a concentration of expertise and the ability to actually talk to each other, you know, regional experts to actually be in the same room and actually trying to come up with some solutions together, again, in more of a cross-discipline, cross-sector way. But again, you've got to be able to allow a little bit of flexibility and build in trust in some of those local voices to be able to allow them to do their work. So I hope for everybody's sake that they're going to be effective.
Yeah, I would say, I think I understand the analogy and being a sports fan. You know, I understand the wanting to sort of think about the Hail Mary. I actually think it's more like the first half of that game, where it's sort of like the 1 and 2 yard gains and the incremental sort of movements. It's that's actually probably where it's in the trenches, as I say. That's where you make the most movement. There's not a single. There actually isn't a panacea, which is sort of the Hail Mary idea that you can just do something and to switch it on. I think in that way. But I agree that we need a change in the approach, and that's why I've talked a lot about this Manhattan Project. Something that gets lost, I think, in this debate, and I'm trying to think about what's the best way to frame this, is to embrace failure, is to think a little bit about, if you ask officers on the ground, as I often do, and I spent time in the field, my first question to them is, tell me which program didn't work. Which program, a USAID, state, maybe it's a civil society program, privately funded, maybe it's funded by, a Carnegie or, some foundation. And the reason is that oftentimes, you can expect, what are the answers I get? What are you talking about? And there's no failure. I mean, this program works so well. And I was like, no, really, tell me. It's okay, I won't tell anybody. This is off the record. It's normally after the third cup of tea or fourth cup of tea that they finally say, okay, fine. This program we tried, because there's so much that we can learn from failure. And this is this idea of learning from failing fast. Some of the best programs, at least that I, in my own research and what I actually instituted and ran, it was eye-opening. Some of the best programs I did were the ones that cost the least. It wasn't the, you know, couple $100,000 programs. It wasn't the big multi-million-dollar programs. It's like $5,000 to a civil society group. It's the kind of work that Mahreen knows very well and others that have worked on the ground know very well, that it's actually those programs end up paying off the most. It's, again, it's a little bit like a venture capital approach, that you're bringing seed capital, you'll do it to 10 groups hoping that maybe one or two take off. Because the ones that do take off, you get exponential kind of returns in terms of their ability to sort of carry out their work. And you have to embrace the idea of, well, why didn't it work in these other ones? And I think that a little bit being more reflective about, you know, and this gets back to your question about success, it really forces us to move more nimbly. I mean, again, I having worked, again, in government, I know the constraints on you know, moving fast. But I do think we have to be more nimble, and I think that's why I advocate this Manhattan Project. You know, on the centers, I would say, I think they can play a role. Having visited the earlier version of Etadol in Saudi Arabia, also been part of the effort that created the Swab Center and other such creations, you know, I think they can be very useful. I would say that, not surprisingly, they tend to defer more to sort of monitoring and censorship as ways of sort of controlling avenues. This idea of, like, let's control modes of speech. Now, on violations of terms of service, the kind of things that Charles was talking about, that anecdote earlier, yes, there's a role for that. But actually, it's about enabling more speech to drown out that counter speech. Actually, that's what the research shows works. And so I would emphasize, and I've continued to emphasize, that Etadol should be working with U-Turn. Look, they're not too far. It's in the neighborhood. You know, that's the kind of, you know, these should be content creation hubs, not censorship hubs, right? So that, to me, is the key point here, that you have to sort of move in that direction. That's what works. I'll just end on this, that a lot of this work is depressing, right? I don't know how you guys feel, but, like, you know, I have to look at propaganda and all this stuff all day. It is very difficult, and it's not sort of uplifting. And what I'll leave you with is something that I try to think about often. It's one of my favorite South Asian poets, Muhammad Iqbal, Allama Iqbal. And he had this couplet, and I'll leave you with this. He said, "Don't get frightened by the furious, violent winds, O eagle. Don't get frightened by the furious, violent winds, O eagle. They only blow to make you fly higher." And I think in a lot of ways, that's our job, all of us collectively, not just for us, but for future generations.
Great. Thank you very much for ending on a positive note, Haroon. I'm sure we all appreciate it. I just want to formally thank Nancy, Shadi, Haroon for what I hope you'll all agree has been a really fascinating panel. We touched on loads of extra subjects. If you're lucky, some of them may still be around for a few minutes if you want to grab them for a final question. But for now, thank you very much for coming, and I hope to see you next time MEI holds another public event. But thank you.